Hi, I'm Ed Mazur, the chairman of the City Club of Chicago, and our public policy luncheon today featured Dr. Bridget Coughlin, the relatively new president and CEO of the Shedd Aquarium. And Dr. Coughlin talked about the aquarium in the 21st century. Over 2 million people visited the aquarium last year. Over 120,000 school buses sent visitors to the aquarium. And the aquarium is developing some new programs to reach out to the community and bring the animal world, there are 32,000 animals in the Shedd Aquarium, out to the community. But don't look for any large sharks.
Well, thank you and welcome. I appreciate sort of the activation barrier it takes to do this, right? To pause your day and to come here as a collective, to get smarter together and then rekindle your day when you go back. So thank you all for coming. I'm joined here by several amazing colleagues from Shedd Aquarium, an incredibly hard-working team. We heard introductions of some of the Board of Trustees that are here, Steve and John, and I know this is kind of campy, but we work with an incredible volunteer board that is really invested in Shedd's rich and successful past and excited for our bright future. So if I could have the trustees of Shedd Aquarium who are here representing the full board, just identify yourself for us. There we go. Thank you. So in thinking ahead of this talk, I thought, kind of dubbed it, that this is, next, I don't know, half an hour or so, is really in my head the pasta, penguin, pufferfish, and a planet presentation. Because that's what it's all about. Ultimately, it's about coexisting and thriving in conjunction with nature and this blue marble that we all call home. So I'm going to divide this talk into three parts. First, I am going to explore the mission of Shedd, because I want you to leave excited about that mission. And it really is about Shedd Aquarium as a portal to the natural aquatic world. And then the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about an aquarium as a business, a non-profit scientific and cultural business, and what are some key strategic drivers that we're looking at that will drive this aquarium deep into the 21st century. And then third, per what is really the secret sauce, I understand, of City Club, ample time for questions and answers, where I will ask you all questions and you will answer and provide the staff and the board shameless free advice that we can poach and take back to advance our work. So I'm very excited about that third part of the presentation. Let's start, though, with nature, the natural aquatic world. Shedd Aquarium is uniquely positioned physically, built on the banks of a body of water that is connected to a collective group called the Great Lakes. And in that Great Lakes contains 20% of all the fresh water available in the world. And that includes shallow subterranean aquifers. 20% of the fresh water in our globe is in our backyard. And then Shedd Aquarium is flanked on the other side by this incredible city, home to 9.4 million residents. And there at that nexus, with water on one side and an urban core of the United States on the other, is our mission: connecting people to the natural aquatic world. And I probably don't need to tell this group why that mission is more important now than ever before. So the United States is increasingly urbanized. 80% of the United States population lives in an urban environment. And with that migration towards urbanization comes some detachment from the natural world. And I know Mike Kelly feels equally strongly about this at Parks, that 30 years ago, the average 10-year-old spent 3 hours in nature play a week. 3 hours of nature play and free exploration and discovery. And now, fast forward 30 years, a 10-year-old spends 30 minutes outside in nature play. And it makes sense. And 1 in 9 children have not stepped a foot in a park or a beach or a forest or any natural environment for the last 12 months. And therein lies Shedd Aquarium's opportunity, and I dare say obligation, about connecting people to the natural world. Because at Shedd, we love the aquatic world and the animals that thrive in it. And we get out of bed every day to go to work because we want a community that loves, understands, and ultimately advocates and protects that big blue marble. So, and there's good things about being urban technology, phones. The Federal Reserve Bank calling. And so here's this opportunity for millions of Chicagoans and tourists and visitors to our city. We get to provide this rare opportunity to see this mysterious world, the aquatic world. And in some cases, it's the only opportunity and a safe opportunity to explore the natural world. So beyond kind of this macro sort of societal dilemma of becoming disassociated with nature and all the ramifications which come with it, including things like childhood obesity or the lack of empathy and the spike and commensurate rise in bullying, you can also just drill down to specific connections to animals. So while we are making attempts to connect people to the natural world and work at this broader scale, there are these moments of delight at the aquarium, because where else can you go to learn why catfish are covered in taste buds? Or why penguins sneeze with great force and great regularity to expel their mucosal fluid, and why that mucosa is many times more salty with higher salinity than yours or mine. And I would like the meeting minutes to reflect that in a city club first, we have explored the body fluids of animals. Or my favorite, sharks. Sharks have been around for 450 million years, 200 million years longer, Richard, than dinosaurs. Museums in the Park is a collaborative, collective, enriching, and then yet there's also, you know, some geeky competition going on. And that sharks, despite their diversity of species and despite an animal having an incredibly long life, sharks rarely, if ever, get cancer. And so we want a generation that will advocate like heck for shark habitat, not only because of their rich natural history, but because of their inspiration and future, our collective future, together. Moving forward, we are going to reinvent Shedd Aquarium and more intentionally and more brilliantly connect people to the animals in our care, all 32,000 of them, to the stories of their cousins out in nature. In the summer of last year, the belugas of the St. Lawrence were listed as an endangered population. The St. Lawrence that connects our Great Lake with the Atlantic Ocean. And debuting next summer in a new educational aquatic presentation, we will tell the story of the belugas in our care and the belugas in the St. Lawrence. It is a story of risk, it is a story of hope, and it is a story of needed intervention. And we can galvanize our visitors to think about the natural world and their role and influence in it. Not only do we connect visitors within our walls, but we have these global outposts. And this is a map just of where Shedd Aquarium in 2015 did conservation research or rescue and rehabilitation research. For the fifth year, we had people from our animal care team down in Cape Town, South Africa, working on the endangered species. We get regular calls from Monterey Bay to look at strandings of sea otters and sea lions. This is Ellie, one of our, she is adorable and a handful. And after lunch, if you'd like Ellie stories, you can grab any one of the Shedd Aquarium teammates to tell you the personality behind this rescued sea otter. And with that, we also do research closer to home. We've tagged sturgeon in New York, look at migratory fish of the Great Lakes, and do sustainable seafood research on conch and grouper down in the Bahamas and the Caribbean on our coral reef research vessel. And translating that work we do from the outside world to the animals that we have in our care is a glimpse of what we're going to do into the future. So I am a biochemist, and I believe in data. And I believe that data can even track the emotional impact and the empathetic influence that going to an aquarium can have. And some of you may have heard this study. It happened in 2015, and it was called the Blue Gym. And researchers at Exeter European Health Center and Plymouth University did a statistically relevant, randomly controlled experiment where they sat people down in front of an aquarium or simply a tank with just kelp. So they had fish in one and kelp, and within 5 minutes, there was a 5 to 10% reduction sustained in their blood pressure. That is my New Year's resolution, not to go to the gym, but just to look at the blue gym. It's much easier, by the way, than Lakeshore Sport and Fitness. And there's no meniscus hazard. When looking at connecting people to the natural world, came to the Shedd Aquarium 9 months ago and really joined the team there on a listening tour. And we listened to stakeholders. Many of you are in the room. And we listened to Chicago Public Schools. And we listened to our colleagues at the park district. And we thought, how can we pivot to do even more? How can we connect more people in deeper ways to the aquatic world, this portal to nature? And it's good to know, when looking to the future, to know about your past. So quick history lesson. Many times we hear about the Adler Planetarium or the Field Museum or Shedd Aquarium built by these sort of titans of commerce. And certainly that was true, but I like to think that Shedd Aquarium was built by a New Hampshire farm boy, John G. Shedd, who left New Hampshire because he had absolutely no desire to work the land with his 6 older siblings. And he brought with it that farm work ethic that I see that ethic still in the team that's at the aquarium today. And he worked his way up from stock boy to eventually president of the Marshall Field Company. And with an initial investment of $3.2 million, he built Shedd Aquarium. Now, fast forward today, our operating budget is $57 million. It is powered by an engine of 670 employees and an incredible core of over 1,000 volunteers. And it's interesting to think what has changed in the past since opening in 1930 versus last year, 2016. Well, strikingly, when we opened, we saw 2 million visitors. And last year we saw 1.93 million visitors. And it's ebbed and flowed and oscillated, but I find that interesting. Now, of course, now people stay longer, they connect more, they experience a much broader biodiversity of the animals that we have in our care. Of course, one animal is still there. Oh, it took, you know, a couple million gallons and 20 round trips of these cars to bring in the salt water from the Florida Keys. We make our own salt water now, so we've gained efficiencies in that way. And visitors back in 1930 could visit Granddad, an Australian lungfish. And Granddad is still there today. He's our longest resident. Granddad is truly the president and CEO of the aquarium, and he just lets me use his office. Clearly some things have really changed. The narrative of conservation and research and the need to keep this urban core connected to the natural world is more important for our society than perhaps it was back in 1930. So we see these 2 million visitors in about 100,000 square feet of available public space. And I did my research in preparation for this talk, and I watched Richard's City Club talk when he was a relatively new president and CEO, and he said that they had 300,000 square feet, an enviable amount of space. And so I'm leading up to some key strategic drivers that we have. So many of our 2 million visitors, as you know, came in family groups. And many of them came on our 52 free days or came on yellow school buses, 120,000 school groups coming on field trips. And an increasing visitor trend we see is that we are seeing an increase in people come, which I call sort of the Noah's Ark, two by two as adult couples. So we have some visitation trends that are changing. We have some attendance numbers that have stayed relatively flat. And we have animals that we have cared for all along. So let's do a thought experiment here for a minute. And so kind of pull yourself out of the food coma we're in from this amazing meal. And let some words kind of free associate into your head. If you say, or if I say, we are going to take a trip to the Shedd Aquarium, what one or two or three words pop into your head? It is not a rhetorical question. What one or two or three words? There's no such thing as free lunch. I mean, you actually have paid for the lunch, but you have to earn it too. Caribbean Reef. Long lines. So I ventured, and I'm not a gambling person, so I knew that someone, and it's not a plant from one of my teammates, would say lines, long lines, or really long lines is the one, two, or three words. We have a challenge, and it keeps us up at night. And we experimented this summer with getting people in faster and having their experience waiting in line better, and really looking at what is the root cause of that. It should be easy to get into the aquarium. We do not want it to be stressful. We don't want to raise your blood pressure just so you can go to the Blue Gym and lower your blood pressure. And part of the root cause of this is, to be honest, needing to up our game in the technology space to drive online sales, to be able to simplify our price structure. We have a multitude of price structures. Do you want a Shedd pass or a VIP experience pass? We have erred on the idea of customization, but it's at the exclusion of ease and intuition. The other is that once you get inside, we know that we have some interior barricades. There are lots of checkpoints telling visitors where they can and cannot go, which we think, and we actually have visitor evaluation, that it hinders that learning experience and that connecting to the natural world because you're constantly traveling to navigate. So we are a labyrinth, and we know it, and we're looking to fix and make higher and better use of our internal space, the space we currently have, to bring in more visitors, more connection, more learning experiences, and that's the recipe we need moving forward. So that gets to some three strands of the business portion of our talk today. Ease, access, and partnership. We need the experience to get in easier. We need to remediate and update some of our exhibits to connect the animals to their counterparts in the natural world. Because as you know, Shedd Aquarium is one of Chicago's best attractions. No reaction from my MIP colleagues, so that's good. The dinosaurs. We're going to have like a dinosaur-dolphin duel. And on most days, we do have lines out the door, and that's a good thing. And then here's the bad thing. Most days, we have lines outside the door. Ease, though, goes hand in hand with access. And access is one of our key strategic drivers. And we're rolling out a few things in the access space. And we think of access both as learning access, making it educationally and experientially accessible to multiple types of learners, as well as access financially. So responding to the shrinking budgets of Chicago public schools, a few weeks ago, we launched an online, on-demand, free science curriculum that maps environmental literacy standards, part of the Next Generation Science Standards, available for all educators. In and of itself, it is robust and complete. It also, if you choose to have a field trip at the aquarium, tracks back very nicely to it. Thinking more about access to a broader group, not just Chicago Public Schools, we are rolling out a gift to Chicago, a Valentine's Day gift. February 10th through the 14th, during our free Illinois resident days, we are expanding the repertoire of exhibits and gallery spaces that you can see. Historically, during free days, we have limited it to our historic galleries. And again, this idea of just being barrier-free and welcoming more people to more experiences, to more connection. For those 5 days, the Illinois residents will have full access to all of our galleries. The shark exhibits in Wild Reef. Someone is applauding. So we have our first customer. And we've also rolled out the ability to buy those Illinois free days passes online. Again, shortening that queue, making it easier, and making it more accessible when you do come. Along with access, we want the access of learning, and we've piloted some really, I think, powerful learning experiences. Last year, we did an audio guide to walk people through the visual aspects of our aquatic presentation. The exhibits and planning and design team also rolled out tactile models so that the visually impaired can learn about a seahorse by touching it, by feeling what it feels like, and connect in a tactile way, if not a visual way, to our animals. And then, following the lead by some of our museums in the park partners, we worked with Infinite Reach to create an app for people with sensory processing disorder like autism. And so instead of a content or a wayfinding map, it is a processing map so that you know where something is high energy or bright, and you can navigate, again, making that shed aquarium more accessible to you. So learning access, price point access, and sampling that, because it is one of our key drivers as we are developing a more robust and long-term strategic plan. So finally, I said ease and access and partnerships. I really believe in partnerships, whether it be with the private sector, fellow nonprofits. We can do more and we can do better if we are together. And about a year ago, the aquarium signed a partnership with colleagues from Monterey Bay Aquarium and National Aquarium called the Aquarium Conservation Partnership. And it was the idea that we wanted to respond to what was happening in the oceans. And many of you have probably read about it. It was a published article from 2015 in Science Magazine that through scientific research, they predicted that by the year 2050, there would be more tonnage of plastic in the ocean than fish. And we believe in fish. And think about how light plastic is, by the way. More weight of plastic than fish in the ocean. And think of the density of, if you've ever held a fish, versus the density of a single-use plastic milk jug. And so with that partnership, we've decided on a few key areas that we are going to look at our own business practices, as well as talk with our community of visitors and members about. One is the idea that we are all passionate about sustainable seafood. The second is around the single-use plastic. By the way, a more recent Rochester Institute study said that within the Great Lakes, 20 million pounds of plastic are put in the Great Lakes on an annual basis. And it's about balancing your quality of life and plastics, but we think that we can do some moderate consumer behavior to help modify that. Today is a special day in the city of Chicago, and unless you're a real geek about tax law, you won't know it. But you will notice when you go to Walgreens and when you go to Target. Chicago has, since 2015, tried to be part of the solution for this plastic pollution epidemic. And that's why when you went, as of 2015, your Walgreens bags were thicker, and the idea was that these bags would be more durable and could be reused or repurposed for an alternative use. But it didn't really drive consumer behavior, and it really put an undue burden on the companies to produce them. And so today, February 1st, a new tax is coming in that charges customers 7 cents for every plastic bag they use. That is a huge step. It has worked in other cities. It is more equitable to the companies and the stores. And I am very interested to see if this second run at a single-use plastic bag tax sticks here. The third part of that aquarium conservation partnership is on marine sanctuaries and seamounts. And the fourth is on sharks, back to sharks, that sharks are a great indicator species, banning shark fin trade, and also monitoring shark populations globally, getting back to that massive map, where we can see the sort of a diagnostic, almost like a canary in the coal mine. I think of it as the shark in the ocean, and that test of the general health of our oceans. We think of sharks as lovable and cuddly, not the movie part, and we want others to think that way too. So those are some of our strategic drivers: ease of getting into the aquarium, more accessible and less confusing when you arrive, fresh new experiences, and then partnerships to help communicate and drive forward a healthier planet that we all share, and we all need to share it for a very long time. So thank you for inviting me. I covered a wide array of things, and now question and answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Coughlin. We have time for questions, so anybody who has a question, just hold up your question. I see one back here. Our staff will come around and pick up those questions.
So I've got my questions.
I know you have your questions. And we'll give you an opportunity to ask those questions. Let's see what the audience has on their plate. Thank you. Thank you, Amanda. Okay, this is from Robert Graham. What can be done to control the lionfish from destroying the Caribbean fish population?
So I think you all know that lionfish, we all wish we had the metabolism of a lionfish. They are voracious eaters, and unfortunately, they are voracious eaters bundled with an absolutely beautiful aesthetic and physiology. I think it begs the bigger question of invasive species writ large, whether it be migratory invasive species, small zebra mussels. You know, a good Great Lake is a cloudy Great Lake that is turbid and not filtered by zebra mussels. And it's interesting, you know, I talked about the priorities of the Aquarium Conservation Partnership, and we really wrestled with invasive species, whether it be lionfish or other. And ultimately, what we need to do as individual conservation-minded aquariums is tell that story so that we can stave off the introduction of more invasive species, because it's often kind of a, you know, the power of one that have introduced it. But also make sure that a certain portion of our budget is allocated to conservation research related to invasive species. One of our most recent hires at the aquarium is Dr. Karen Murchie, and she does migratory fish of the Great Lakes and looking at how locks and dam systems and that migratory fish could impact the invasive species of the Great Lakes. So I think you have to bring the narrative forward to visitors. We need to also walk the talk, so to speak, and deploy a certain amount of energy towards conservation research targeting that topic.
Thank you. This is from Mike Vasilko. Mike, where are you? Over there. Tremendous printing. Can actually read this question, as opposed to a couple others up here. How does the budget impasse in Springfield? Is it causing financial harm to cultural institutions like the Shed?
So it definitely adds a layer of complexity that I think me and my colleagues would all agree we would rather do without. There is a certain amount of capital funding that is sent our way, and then, of course, if it is said that it's going to be sent our way and doesn't, it can cause cash issues and balance sheet challenges. I think the bigger issue is that I don't think any one of the museums in the park, presidents and CEO, well, this is now dangerous because I'm just going to speak on a collective of a dozen so organizations, that moving forward, we really don't plan on that money, right? We are sort of, unfortunately, in an environment where we are assuming the worst rather than hoping for improvement. And that says a lot about the long-term impact of our capital improvement projects. But I think it's happened with such regularity that our board should probably hold us accountable to not plan for the hopeful, but plan for the likely. And that's a unique state of affairs.
Thank you. This is from one of my former students, Chester Kropodlowski, who's a retired city employee. He says, I took a class in fishing rod building at the aquarium many years ago. Chester, where are you? Okay, that wasn't on city time, I hope. Forget about any statute of limitations, pal. Does the aquarium now offer any classes for area fishermen to learn about Great Lakes fishing?
Yeah, we don't, but we certainly know good partners that do. And here's what's interesting. Many of you probably have the Monterey Bay Seafood app downloaded on your phone, and it used to be really simple, the story of fishing. What to get and when to get it. But now, the lesson is not what to get, what type of fish, or when to get it, spring or summer, but how it was caught. So that fly reel or the rod versus netting versus trolling is far more weighted. And so it's an interesting thing, Chester, that sustainable seafood is actually not often about the biology of the animal or the habitat degradation of the animal, but how it is caught because of the bycatch challenge that it has. So we have not taught fishing classes, and yet one of our target areas, sustainable seafood, it's actually top on the list of things that could positively impact it. And I'm just hoping you kept your rod.
Okay. And in just a few weeks, you'll find coho fishermen out there with their power lines. You know, the fish will be coming in close to shore, so they'll be out there. This is from Dr. Linda, I'm going to butcher it, I apologize, Leonez from Regina Dominican High School up there in Wilmette. What are some ways that high schools can partner with the Shed?
So I aspire to be a high school student that gets to go on one of our summer explorations on that Coral Reef 2 research vessel. That is my career aspiration. Haven't shared that with my board yet, but that is why I took the job, to try to figure out how to be in our high school marine biology program. Now, that's one extreme where you're actually going out, you're doing a research study, and you are contributing to citizen science, and you are truly the scientific driver of that research. There's a whole suite, though. We run complex businesses. We have teens in the finance division over the summer. We have teens shadowing our development and our philanthropy team. It is really a broad spectrum. So whether you're interested in marine biology or accounting or guest services or aquatic education storytelling, we have a variety of both internships and employment opportunities over the summer.
Thank you. Very short question. Charles, I think your first name is Charles. Your last name starts with an S. I can't read it. How old is Francis? I think he's referring to the Australian. Yeah, Granddad. How old is Granddad, the Australian lungfish?
So Granddad came to us in 1933. He was not a juvenile at that time, but we don't, it's not like tree ring dating. We don't exactly know. So it was relatively full grown, so not a juvenile. So he's at least 87 years old, probably more like 90.
Yeah, in a little discussion I had with Bridget beforehand, I said when I'm taking tourists around the city, I tell them that the oldest animal in the aquarium is Granddad. I said 106 years old. And they say, does it move very often? And I said, no, either would you if you were 106. Tweet Thornton. What's the best way to become a volunteer at the shed? Maybe we're not giving them enough to do, Jay.
So it depends. My second aspiration is to be one of our volunteer scuba divers. Because it is harder than getting into Harvard. There is a wait list. It is incredibly competitive. You don't even get a full shift. You have to work every other week, and then we only let you do it for a half a day. So we have an incredible volunteer office. I think it just speaks to the culture at Shedd Aquarium. Earlier today, I had someone who said, my daughter volunteered there, and we would have paid you to have her work there. And I thought, well, that's a differentiated business model I have not explored. We have an incredible volunteer staff that coordinates. There's an intake process where they explore what our opportunities are, but what are your interests, and then it's this incredible art of matchmaking, and there are always open positions, except if you want to scrub algae off of a glass, and then you have to really build your resume to get that job.
And if you want to add to the budget line, maybe you should consider auctioning those off to the highest bidder, raise a little money.
I know we get good ideas.
We'll get to your questions after this last question.
Oh, no,
this is from Christy Uchida, who's with the Brinson Foundation. Very broad question. What about reaching beyond the aquarium's walls to expand ease and access? You've addressed some of this, but you may have something else to say.
I paid the Brinson Foundation $20 to ask that question. So we talked about some of the key strategic drivers about ease and access, seeing more people, making their experience better, connecting our research in the outside world, and what's happening in the outside world, like the belugas being listed as an endangered population. But every single one of the Shedd Aquarium team would be able to answer this question, because a huge driver of our strategic plan we're dubbing the here, there, and everywhere. How do we see people better here at the aquarium, there in learning outposts? And those learning outposts might be with partners and at the Forest Preserve, or in outposts in the city. You know, I think it was brilliant that Adler Planetarium recommissioned a bunch of food trucks this summer and deployed them out in the city and said, hey, you want to come pick up a meteorite? Ha ha, it's heavy, it's full of lead. What a crazy great idea. And so we want to see more people here, there, out in outposts. It might be on the water, it might be in the forest, it might be on Wacker Drive, and then everywhere. And really doing digital opportunities, because if you have, you guys are all not millennials, because I don't see anyone's phones out. And that's just part of their ethos. It's at, okay, my chairman of the board has his phone out. And so everywhere, how do you have a Shedd Aquarium experience on your mobile device, on demand? I would love to be the Pinterest of the natural world, where people can pin and tag and curate their own images or their own, hey, that I like that blade of grass. I might want to look at that blade of grass later and pin it. And so there is a definite strand in our emerging strategic plan about growth here, there, and everywhere.
Thank you. And now you said you had a few questions.
Well, he's calling my bluff.
Absolutely.
So I did ask that question that I didn't think was rhetorical, really is just to goad you into talking about our lines. Because, by the way, when I told people in Denver that I was taking this job, I had numerous people say, oh, you're going to fix the lines, right? You're going to... I was like, yes. And obviously it's complicated, or we would have adjusted that and arrived at a solution a long, long time ago. But I am curious what other things leapt into your mind that you think that the aquarium should think about.
Way in the back.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lillian, by the way. I think the building is beautiful architecture and lines and sight lines.
Yeah, the we have given an incredible architectural tour, and the, one of the most fantastic docents that does this is our chief operating officer, Mike Delfini, up here, sort of that Nautilus structure. And what's happened in all the improvements at the aquarium, and you can see it when you visit, is that we have escaped some of the architectural woes when we adjusted the interior of, let's just be honest, decades where there were sort of architectural woes to be had. Little known fact, when we built the Oceanarium on the backside, that round portion that juts out over the water that I showed a picture about, when they built that building, the marble slabs that skin the building were 12 to 18 inches thick. And so when they removed the backside for the Oceanarium, there was sufficient depth to plane them and then skin the new addition on the building so that there is continuity of look. And so just from the exterior to the interior, it is part of that environment that makes you ready to learn. And we want to complement that ready to learn with kind of an ease of access and wayfinding.
I'm glad you asked that question, Dr. Diane. And, of course, this is the city where the skyscraper was born. Big story in the paper today about plans for redeveloping the Willis, formerly the Sears Tower. And the architects, Graham Anderson, Probst & White, successor to Daniel Burnham's company, and the addition by Dirk Lohan, the grandson of Mies van der Rohe. Absolutely fantastic. Speaking of volunteers and that, you know, 120,000 buses a year drop off school kids, if I got your numbers correctly. The people that handle those buses and the volunteers and staff inside the aquarium are to be highly commended. They're just terrific, just terrific. Yes? Oh, okay. We just have a couple items left. If I could ask our let's give Dr. Coughlin a hand.